Hello, this is Future Tense. Welcome to the program. Anthony Fennell here. As part of today's show, we're talking about narcissism. And I know exactly who you're now thinking of.
I pay tax and I pay federal tax too.
No, turn it off.
I have a write-off.
None of that. We don't want to talk about that guy. Rest assured, we're not even going to mention his name. If we can help it. At least that's the intention. He gets enough free airtime. In a world surrounded by narcissists and narcissism, Dr. Christian Jarrett is here to explain why they should actually be pitied, not necessarily admired or even feared. We'll also talk about the modern need to confess with technology and culture writer Navneet Alang, and we'll find out about a new X-ray technique that's helping archaeologists and historians to gain an even greater understanding of the past.
We believe there will be an expanding number of items that are perfectly suited for this kind of analysis. And there are large numbers of damaged things in archives, museums, libraries all over the world. Normally, a museum or a library will lead with undamaged things, with beautiful things, with things that to the naked eye can be displayed and look fantastic. But always in the crevices of the archive are things that have been carefully maintained, but they're just not brought forward because nothing can really be done with them. And I think this is the kind of technology that can bring that out.
Brent Seals from the University of Kentucky, and we'll hear more from him shortly. Let's start in the UK, though, with Dr. Christian Jarrett, who's been investigating the growing rise of narcissism within society and what it means for our future. Dr. Jarrett is the editor of the British Psychological Society's Research Digest. I began by asking Dr. Jarrett to tell us about two tests used by psychologists to better understand narcissistic tendencies, the explicit association test and what's called the bogus pipeline technique.
So the implicit association test, the idea is this is revealing what people think about themselves without them knowing that's what they're doing. And basically words flash up on a screen and you have to press a certain button depending on the category of word. Now, narcissists are really quick when the same key is allocated to words that relate to themselves, words like me, mine, or myself, and words like pain, agony, and death. So quite the opposite of what you would think. It suggests that deep down at a subconscious level, they have very negative connotations about themselves. And the other one, the bogus pipeline technique, again, there's trickery involved. With this one, psychologists trick their participants into thinking they've wired them up to a kind of lie detection machine. And again, this time, if you ask narcissists, people who score highly on questionnaire measures of narcissism in these studies, ask them about their self-esteem levels, how good they feel about themselves. When they think they're wired up to a lie detection machine, they report actually very low self-esteem, which suggests, you know, it's actually a lot of it is bravado normally, because they normally talk very highly of themselves, obviously. So these kind of tests that get round their bravado suggest underneath they are insecure and needy.
I'll ask you about some of the neural research that's been done on narcissism in just a second, but if we know that narcissists are fragile underneath, is it possible then to alter our strategies to rather than feel frustrated about them, but to try and steer their narcissism? Is it possible to steer their narcissism in a good way?
I think so, yeah. Well, because there are actually some strengths to being narcissistic in the sense of, for example, there's some evidence it can help to have a couple of narcissists on your team if you're working on a creative project or something, trying to come up with new ideas or a new strategy. Because these kind of characters, because they want the attention, because they've got this, on the surface at least, inflated sense of their importance, they're not afraid to put forward sometimes, you know, pretty novel, bold ideas. And it can kind of help foster competitiveness within the team. So these characters do have their advantages. They can be very persistent. So if you have somebody on your team like this, they can presumably, because they want, you know, they're after that reward and recognition. You know, they can be very show a lot of endurance and persistence and determination. So if you can get them to dial down maybe the obnoxious stuff, then, you know, people like this have their upsides as well, which, we can try and exploit.
So you don't want too many of them on your team, and you also don't want them in charge, I would imagine.
Yeah, there's some interesting findings there too, actually, because narcissists can seem very appealing in a leadership role at first. There was a study recently that likened narcissistic leaders to chocolate cake in that the first couple of spoonfuls, delicious, very appealing, but have too much, and you know, you start to feel sick, and it's the novelty wears off very quickly. And that tends to be what you get with narcissistic leaders, because at first their boldness, their vision, their self-importance, it can for a very short time be inspiring, until of course you realize it's all about them, and the glean where, you know, the sheen wears off.
Now, you've talked about the psychological studies into narcissism. What about the neurological studies that have gone on? What have they told us?
Well, they confirm this picture, really. There's one study where researchers had students play this online game called Cyberball, which basically just involves the different players passing a ball to each other backwards and forwards. But they set things up so that sometimes the participants were rejected by the other players. The ball was never passed to them. Now, among the participants, those who were narcissistic, according to questionnaires, you know, they said they weren't bothered by this afterwards. They couldn't care less that they'd been rejected. No big deal. But the trick here was that they were having their brain scanned all during this. And they actually showed the narcissistic participants were the ones who showed the most activity that's associated with feelings of social pain and rejection. So again, it fits this picture that, you know, they're telling you they're full of themselves and confident. But this time at a neural level, the suggestions were they were really hurt by the rejection more than most people.
And there's also been suggestions that they might have a deficit in their reward circuit. Explain that to us.
Well, this was a different kind of brain scanning study that looked at connectivity. So the different patterns of connectivity, the tissues joining up different brain regions. And this time, narcissistic participants turned out they seemed to have a very weak, reduced connection between parts of the brain that we use to think about ourselves. It's called the medial prefrontal cortex. And another area, which is all to do with reward and pleasure, the ventral striatum. And they had reduced connectivity between these two areas. And these researchers suggested this means, you know, they actually find it difficult to link pleasurable thoughts and feelings with their self and their sense of self. And perhaps that's why these characters are constantly trying to get this affirmation from external sources, you know, from attention and recognition.
Now, we hear quite often the idea expressed that the technology that we use today, which is very much focused on us, that leads to greater levels of narcissism within society. Is that suggestion based on any kind of scientific fact that you know of? I mean, are narcissists made, or is it a genetic trait?
Bit of both, I think. And there is definitely questionnaire evidence. You know, when you give people questionnaires, ask them questions about themselves, there is evidence that narcissism is on the rise. Now, when it comes to technology, you know, things like taking selfies, I guess, and posting them online and tweeting about your every movement, I'm not sure, you know, what's cause and effect. I don't know if we're embracing that more because we're becoming a more narcissistic, individualistic society. So that's why we want to do more of this. And that's reflected in our use of technology, or whether the opportunity to do this, because it's easier now than ever for any one of us, isn't it, to kind of broadcast about ourselves to the world on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. I don't know if that's fostering more narcissism. I would think it's probably both, a kind of a vicious circle going on. I know that people who score higher in narcissism unsurprisingly do things like post more selfies and post more self-centered updates and so on, you know, which is just what you'd expect. There's a spectrum here. I think we're probably all guilty of being narcissistic sometimes. So it's a spectrum, it's a question of degree, and actually taken to its to very serious end of the scale, it can become a kind of a diagnosable mental health condition.
Dr. Christian Jarrett, and he's from the British Psychological Society. And just so there's absolutely no misunderstanding, when he said there that we were all guilty of narcissism at times, he wasn't talking about us, you and me. He meant other people.
The door to the confessional opened. I heard the person sit, and I waited. What have you come to confess, my child? Listening to the heavy breathing in the booth next to me. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned, the man's voice announced. I've tried to be a good man, Father. I'm sure you have. No one is born evil.
It's been a long time since I visited a confessional, and without giving too much away about my own personality, my attitude has always been that unless you have a warrant, I'm not confessing to anything. But some people can't help themselves. I'm not talking about the religiously motivated, I mean some people online. Confessional apps are popular, believe it or not, and according to technology writer Navneet Alang, they're all part of what he calls shouting into the void.
Confessional apps, that is, apps that you can use to sort of store secrets, or you can put secrets on for other people to read and do so anonymously, started a few years ago. Probably the most popular or most significant one was a website called PostSecret that still exists. But it began essentially that people could submit things that they wanted to confess anonymously, and then they were placed on the site, and they went up once a week, and you could scroll through them. And some of them were quite banal, sort of minor transgressions, and some of them were, you know, quite serious, you know, spouses who were gay and couldn't come out of the closet, people who had committed not so much crimes, but things that they felt guilty about and didn't want to share those with the people in their lives. And then a few more apps came out. One of them was called Whisper, that became popular particularly amongst young people, at which they would just sort of post things that they just couldn't bear to tell their friends in real life, but they could share with the internet. And I think that phenomenon or that trend is something that people started to use technology in sort of slightly uncharacteristic ways to do the same thing. So that is that they would start up anonymous Twitter accounts just to kind of share things without being attached to a face, or even actually speaking to technology to, I guess, get the catharsis of saying something out loud.
Now, these confessional apps got you thinking about the way in which we communicate with social media and this idea, as you say, of shouting into the void, the need to shout into the void. Just explain that to us.
Maybe I could tell you a story that I went to New York on vacation by myself. I was staying in an apartment for 2 weeks, and I found myself using an Amazon Alexa, which is a small kind of black cylinder. That's something called a smart speaker, but you can ask it what the weather is outside, what's the news, you can add things to your shopping list. But it has this sort of faux personality that you can communicate with as well, so that it will tell you a joke if you ask it to, or you can get it to play music. And I found that I would ask it a question, and then I would say thank you to this inanimate black cylinder on a kitchen counter. And I found myself sort of feeling slightly less alone when I was using it. And so I think that idea of shouting into the void is that we will often express things onto or using technology where we don't expect a response from another person, but the fact that we get a response at all. And so for example, you know, these digital assistants like Amazon's Alexa or Apple Siri or Microsoft's Cortana, they're sort of built to respond to you in a way where, you know, if you say thank you, they will say to you, you're welcome. And there's something strangely sort of compelling about something that almost feels like a human connection, that there's kind of a cathartic effect to, as I say, shouting into the void, because the void occasionally seems to speak back.
And just picking up on that, I mean, you argue, don't you, that with a lot of our interactions on social media, the fact that people may not be responding to what we post or to what we tweet doesn't really matter. That's not so much the point of it.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a dimension to that. And you know, obviously, when we use Facebook and we use Twitter, a lot of the time we're expecting a reaction from other people. But what happens frequently, I think, is that, A, we want the release of just expressing an idea. But secondly, I think what we want is to express something without getting any negative pushback, which doesn't happen all the time, obviously. You know, you can express something on social media and you can get a lot of negative feedback. But one of the things that I think can feel constraining about the relationships in our day-to-day lives is that you can say something and you know exactly the reaction that you're going to get, that you're going to get, you know, a disapproval, or you're going to get a pat on the head, or it's going to be something that you expect. When you express something into technology in a way that there is no actual response, you can almost sort of imagine the perfect response instead. You can put that in its place. And I think that that actually has a psychological effect on us. I think that we still get something from sort of throwing something out there into that blankness and being able to imagine that we are being heard in the way that we want to be heard.
So in a strange sort of sense then, I mean, we like to think, or we often think, that social media is about us crafting an image of ourselves, and certainly that's part of it. But from what you're saying there, what's also important to a lot of people is them actually crafting an image of an imagined audience out there.
Yeah, I think that that is really sort of fundamental. I think that the audience that we have in mind when we post things to social media isn't our real audience all the time. Sometimes it can be. But sometimes I think that it's sort of this assumption of the person who understands us the way that we want to be understood. And I think that part of that is about wanting that perfect other, like wanting to be seen the way that we want to be seen. And I think the other dimension of that is sometimes I think of it a little bit like Cinderella's slipper, which is to say that we kind of throw these things out there into this anonymous void, hoping that, the one or two people who truly get what we mean, who understand the world in the same way that we do, will see that and pick it up. And so I think that there's both of those dimensions going on at once. One is the imagined audience that doesn't really exist but seems perfect to us. And the other is the hope that that imagined audience will somehow become real, that we're going to find those people that we truly connect with.
And that explains, doesn't it, why, you see some people on social media, take Facebook, for example, they might post quite often but get no responses back, get no likes from people, but continue to post updates. You know, you might wonder why, but what you're saying there explains that kind of behavior, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, at least it's a theory behind it. And I'm sure that there could be more than one reason as to why people do that. But I think that people will often, even despite the fact that there is no reaction, will often do that out of a sense of hope, but also, as I say, like out of a desire for catharsis, like to get those ideas out. And I think that there's something connected to the idea of the diary, right? Like one of the reasons that the diary became so popular is that in formalizing our thoughts, that is, in forcing ourselves to write them out, we could really sort of confront or deal with what we were thinking. And I think that people use Facebook and Twitter and other forms of social media in a similar fashion, which is to say that in having some sort of an aesthetic or formal dimension to what we're saying, it helps us to kind of grapple with them, to kind of come to terms with what it is that is actually going on in our head.
That challenges the common idea that we have of this type of behavior, because we tend to think that social media is all about communication.
Yeah, and I think it still is about communication, but it's almost like instead of there being someone sending a message and someone receiving a message, there's almost like another step in between. And that is that you almost have to kind of go through the imagined audience to get to what is actually intended. And what I mean by that is that when you look at social media and you think about, well, why are people posting? Like, why are they saying these things? Why are they posting pictures of their meals? Why are they angrily reacting to politics? Why are they talking about the things that they're happy about or they're sad about? And I think so much of that has to do with this desire to kind of speak to some sort of idealized sense of an audience that understands us as we wish to be. And so I think that it's almost like you have to look at social media with that sort of that doubled view, or the perspective of what someone is literally trying to say and what someone might be trying to say in a slightly less direct or less conscious sense, but still expressing some kind of desire for understanding, for compassion, for empathy, for just the simple pleasure of being seen by another human being. And I think that dynamic is sort of key to understanding why people use social media the way that they do.
And Navneet Alang is a technology and culture writer based in Toronto. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. And now to Professor Brent Seals from the Department of Computer Science at the University of Kentucky and the new X-ray technique he's devised for reading ancient scrolls.
En-Gedi is a town on the shore of the Dead Sea, not from Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually found. It's a desert oasis, so it's very famous for the springs there. It actually appears in the Bible. It's mentioned that Saul and King David were hiding in caves and refreshing in the springs at En-Gedi.
After over four decades, an ancient puzzle is solved.
When the ancient Jewish village of En-Gedi dating back from the Byzantine period, was completely destroyed by fire. It's likely none of the survivors ever returned to claim their property. When archaeological excavations began on the village site, charred scroll fragments were discovered in a burned-out synagogue.
The archaeological site was actually discovered in the late 1960s, and it turned out that there was a synagogue that was discovered right in the old town of En Gedi, and in the floor of that synagogue, which, by the way, is a beautiful mosaic floor, you can still see it, it's preserved as a national park. But in that floor was the original Holy Ark of the synagogue, and it was inside that Holy Ark that this scroll was actually discovered in 1970.
Virtual unwrapping begins by acquiring a three-dimensional volumetric scan of the damaged manuscript. This scan produces a set of cross-sectional images that show the internal structure of the scroll.
There must have been some kind of serious event that occurred that destroyed the synagogue, because everything within that ark was badly burned, probably thought destroyed by whatever event occurred. And so when it was pulled from the earth, it was fragmentary and very, very fragile. Basically, it's in a state where it's impossible to sort of open up the layers. And because it's a scroll, it's rolled up.
And so here comes your technique. You come into the scene. You're looking at the scroll. If you try and unroll it, it will just fall apart. So tell us about the technique that you've applied to the scroll in order to understand what's written in it.
For a while, we've been thinking about how to image something without opening it at all, without touching it, a complete non-invasive solution for extremely fragile things. The basis of the idea is tomography, which is an X-ray-based technique that can see all the way through something, but produces data that's completely three-dimensional. So you see through it, but you also know for everything inside its position and location in three dimensions. That's the starting point for us to be able to see the writing inside. After the original scanning, you produce the contents of the scroll, if you will, this three-dimensional space inside, but you need a way to completely unwrap that because it's all, of course, tightly rolled. We have software that walks through several stages to be able to take that data and transform it into something that essentially looks like a photograph of what it would look like if you could completely unroll it and take a picture. So all of that is done in software.
And so the algorithms in that software actually decipher what or actually put the pieces of the jigsaw together, so to speak.
Exactly right. We go after the locations in that scan of where all of the surfaces are, the places where there's writing. And in small pieces, we build out what those layers look like and then put them all together in a final flattened kind of collage. Of course, it's all very tightly controlled by the software because we know where everything is in the volume and how they all line up. And so it's just a tedious process, of course, with the aid of the software, of finding all that and putting it together.
And is the scroll impacted in any physical way by this technology? I presume it's not.
Oh, that's the beauty of it. It's completely non-invasive. And because it's an inanimate object, no DNA, no living, breathing thing, the ionizing radiation is actually completely harmless to the object. So you can scan it as long as you need. You can get incredibly high resolution. It's really remarkable in that sense.
Now, these ancient scrolls come in varying lengths. Is that an issue here? Are the numbers of layers within a scroll, are they important in terms of the ability of this technique to read what's written in the scroll?
You know, X-rays interact as they go through with whatever the object is. And because the animal skin or typical paper that you write on, papyrus, whatever the material is, because it's relatively so light or transparent compared to the X-ray, we really don't have any problems with many, many numbers of layers. I think what the bigger problem is that the geometry, the shape of all the layers inside this space, it's completely unpredictable and usually badly damaged. So it's a fair amount of work to just find all the layers and pull them out.
So tell us about the accuracy of the text which the program comes up with. Is there a way of gauging how accurate that final product is compared to the original scroll?
Oh, absolutely. What's really interesting is that this technique produces an image based on the geometry, the shape of everything, but it's completely unaware and agnostic to the writing, the language. So when we put this result together, I don't speak Hebrew. I don't read Hebrew. I hand that off to a scholar who reads that image and can either read it or not, and they can evaluate how that looks. And it's kind of got its own built-in control. The scholar can tell how good the Hebrew looks, if it's readable and where there are problems, and that's the beauty of it.
Now, there are many scrolls, aren't there, in the world, ancient scrolls that are out there in museums and in research laboratories that haven't been able to be unraveled. I take it then the implications for this type of technology are quite significant for archaeology and for our understanding of history.
We believe there will be an expanding number of items that are perfectly suited for this kind of analysis. And there are large numbers of damaged things in archives, museums, libraries all over the world. Normally, a museum or a library will lead with undamaged things, with beautiful things, with things that to the naked eye can be displayed and look fantastic. But always in the crevices of the archive are things that have been carefully maintained, but they're just not brought forward because nothing can really be done with them. And I think this is the kind of technology that can bring that out.
So this technology isn't just going to be useful for ancient scrolls. It can be used with other forms of archaeology.
Oh, absolutely. I know for a fact that, for example, there are items that were found from the Franklin expedition in the Northwest Passage. They're actually in the Greenwich Museum in London. And those papers, although they're badly damaged from being in the Arctic, you know, they're compacted together, you know, those are only a couple hundred years old. But how interesting would it be to use a technology like this to look inside those papers and see if there's actually writing from the expedition?
And where do you go from here with your technique and with the research that you're doing?
Well, there are technical challenges. You know, the X-rays interact with the chemistry of the ink, with the kind of material that you're talking about. Every one of these objects, as you can well imagine, is completely unique. The damage is always profound. So there are technical advances that I believe can still be made. And I would love to see the community at large sort of scale up our ability to analyze things that are in the nooks and crannies of collections worldwide. For that reason, we're planning on releasing the software we've developed into an open source status so that other people can use and build on what we've done.
And what do we know about the En-Gedi scroll? What did it turn out to be in the end?
So yeah, this is a fantastic story. The text was a known text. It's portions of the first two chapters of Leviticus. So it turns out that it's a Torah scroll. And it's a very early copy of Leviticus. And it's also word for word, letter for letter, exact in terms of a match to the Masoretic text we now have. This is not my finding. It's from the scholars who did the analysis. And that's really interesting because the scrolls in Qumran were not settled necessarily. This is probably the earliest example of a Hebrew text that is word for word accurate to the Masoretic.
Well, Professor Brent Seals from the University of Kentucky, thank you very much for your time on Future Tense.
Anthony, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks.
And we'll be back again next week with another edition of the show. Thanks to Edwina Stott, my co-producer for this particular program, and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.